I'd like to thank Bob once again and introduce our duo of speakers, Jared Trost and Bill Simpkins. So now we're moving into the real nitty-gritty of groundwater and glacial sediments and data collection and modeling to try and understand groundwater flow. So for this, I'm very pleased to introduce our next two speakers, and they'll be Jared will be starting out, followed by Bill. So Jared is a hydrologist with the USGS. He obtained his BA from Augsburg College and his master's in water resource science from the University of Minnesota. Bill is a professor of hydrology at Iowa State University. He obtained his BA from Augustana College and his master's and PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So, Jared and Bill, I want to learn about the tortoise and the hare.
Well, welcome back, everybody. So we actually end this presentation with expect surprises, so I guess we're already starting there. The title of this talk is Groundwater Flow Through Till, Tortoise, Hare, or Not in the Race. And you can see some of the, we've already had a nice tour through different tills in the state and across the country, but here's a picture of a couple of tills that, of cores that we had in this project. And this is a picture of a well nest that we installed at Litchfield as part of this project. And so I'd like to acknowledge a number of people that have helped with this project along the way. I'm Jared Trost, and Bill Simpkins is here. And then Anna, his Bill's graduate student, is here presenting a poster, so make sure you check that out, also on this project. Alyssa Witt is a former graduate student of Bill's. Andrew is a technician that did a lot of the data collection on the project. Jim Stark, he started this project, and I kind of picked it up in the middle. Bob Tipping did a lot of geologic interpretations. Justin, aquifer test interpretations. And then Daniel Feinstein helped with some of the modeling I'll be talking about today. Here is a list of the various agencies and places involved with this study. And this wouldn't have been possible without the cooperation from the cities where we installed our well nests. And so I really want to compliment the cities for working with us, Litchfield, Cromwell, and Olivia, and then the University of Minnesota for letting us put some holes in the ground at their hydro camp site. Major funding for this came from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, and major in-kind support came from Bill Simpkins. He's had two graduate students work on this project, and none of the money actually went to Bill, so he's been a tremendous support for this project. And so it comes to the next point that people from Iowa and Minnesota can work together, and people from Iowa are actually quite nice. And so I'm giving an introduction to this, and then Bill is going to get into a lot of the field data, and as was mentioned, the nitty-gritty, and so these big-scale mapping efforts, what does it mean on a small scale? And so he's going to get into that, and then I'll talk a little bit about some interpretive modeling at the end of this talk. And then this afternoon, Justin Blum is going to give a riveting talk on aquifer test analysis of these sites. And then there's also a couple of posters in the poster session about this project. So thinking about this project and kind of where this project came in, confined aquifers provide drinking water to thousands of people in Minnesota and across the country. And the question is, how sustainable are these water supplies? And so we have a way that we like to think about tills. I was kind of reflected in that schematic that Bob showed in the L score. You know, we like to think of these as an unlimited water supply. Contaminants stop, water keeps appearing, and we keep pumping, and it's great. But how realistic is this? And so this study was set up to try to get at questions like that. And so it became a focus on till. So the sustainability of these buried aquifers becomes a question about till. How does groundwater flow through till? How long does it take water to move through till? And how susceptible are aquifers to contamination? So our overall project goal was to, for different glacial lobes and till units in Minnesota, quantify the variability of till hydraulic properties and quantify the leakage of water from till confining units to buried confined aquifers. and all with the goal to better understand the sustainability of these water supplies. Okay, and so we studied several different major units across the state, and we had sites on the Superior Lobe, the Wadena Lobe, and the Des Moines Lobe. And what went into, so in order for a city or a municipal supply to be considered as a candidate site, we wanted it to have detailed site information, so a geologic atlas, a wellhead or source water protection plan, or other information that was relevant, like the HydroCamp site. They have a lot of detailed information there already. Some physical limitations: we wanted a small number of high-capacity wells completed in the buried aquifer, so we weren't having competing pumping interference. We wanted that confined aquifer to be less than 300 feet from land surface, and we wanted the wells themselves to have good construction, so we weren't having leaky borehole problems. And then logistically, we needed sites to have a cooperative water operator, obviously, and we needed the sites to be accessible with a large drill rig. And so this is where we did our study. And so we had four sites across the state. The first that I mentioned here is the Hydro Field Camp up near Akeley, Minnesota. And the population up there is pretty small. It's 30 to 40 for about 3 weeks in the summer. And other than that, bear, deer, squirrels, and that kind of thing. Unless Scott goes up there more often, I don't know. But anyway, it wasn't a high-demand aquifer, but there it was set up really well for long-term aquifer tests, so we could learn some interesting things about till there. Cromwell, a small city, and that was on the Superior Lobe. Litchfield, a little bit larger city on the Des Moines Lobe. And Olivia, which is in the footprint of the Des Moines Lobe, but the tills there are actually older. The Des Moines is essentially absent there. So what we did at each site, we first characterized the profile with a continuous core, and that we used that continuous core to identify places where we wanted to put screens for our well nest. And this is a picture of Bob Tipping in his glory looking at cores. And so this is the basic design that we put in at these sites then. We have the till confining unit and then this underlying aquifer next to a high-capacity pumping well. And that first core that we did typically ended up being a well screened in the aquifer. And then after that, we would place these screens. Our aquifer well was a 2-inch diameter well, and our till wells were 1.25 inches, and that's because till responds slowly. And we did slug tests on these, and it takes a lot less time to fill up a 1.25 inches than a 2-inch well. So that's why we use small diameter wells with 3-foot screens. And the core we retrieved core sections from each of the screened intervals, and we took those core sections and squeezed them to get pore water samples. And Bill will talk about the pore water. Ideally, we would have a well nest both close to the pumping well and far from the pumping well. This ideal situation was only realized at Litchfield. And so Bill will talk about that. We have two separate well nests, and they're actually very interesting. And so the data that we collected, we did a lot of hydrologic data collection, water levels and precipitation. We did slug tests on all the wells, and we did aquifer tests at all four sites. And I forgot to put Scott's name in here. The HydroCamp, at the HydroCamp site, Bob and Scott ran the aquifer tests there. And we did a lot of geochemical analyses on the water samples, major ions and nutrients, stable isotopes, and tritium. So with that, I will invite Bill up here to get into the nitty-gritty.
Thanks, Jared, for that great introduction. So I'm here to deliver the goods, as they say. And just to make it clear here, we're talking about till confining units in some part of the world. In my part of the world, I call these aquitards. And in Carrie's part of the world, it's called overburden. And thank you again for letting me come back up and migrate across the Iowa border. This is a fun place to be. Okay, I thought I'd start with a little geology. We've seen a lot of this, and thank all of you that preceded me for great preparatory work. We have four sites, actually, that are four different till units. You can go across the top here. Let's see if I can get this right. Oh, yeah. This is a challenge. All right. So basically, we don't know what the lobe is. It's probably a northwest, maybe Winnipeg source. It's got a lot of carbonate in it. But it turns out to be pre-Illinoisan. So we were expecting Des Moines Loeb there. It's in the Des Moines Loeb, and lo and behold, we didn't get that, which makes it even neater. Okay. Litchfield's the Des Moines Loeb, Cromwell Superior, and the hydro camp is Wadena. These are all late Wisconsin episode tills. We're looking at Good Thunder, New Ulm, Cromwell, and Hewitt. And I've ordered these so that the clayer samples are at the left and the sandier ones are to the right. So basically you have 37% sand in the Olivia and in the HFC at the hydro camp at 67%. So we go from clay loam to loamy sand in the textural triangle. So we have, by design or by luck, we were able to kind of span the range of a lot of till units except for the clays, which we did not address in this study. And I do want to talk, I just want to mention here, thanks to all the people at MGS, we had a ton of people out there. I could not have put the stuff in the boxes or lifted the boxes or put them in the truck and done all the description. That's stuff I usually used to do, but I've lost those skills. So it's good that Bob and the group came along. Okay, so this is a kludged together site stratigraphy diagram showing all the sites at different scales. I ran out of time to do a really beautiful diagram, so you'll just have to live with this one. But I'll call your attention to where the aquifers are. So the aquifer is here at Olivia. It's here at Litchfield 1, which is the one site. It's a little higher here at Litchfield 2, or maybe a little deeper, actually, according to the scale. Cromwell, it's here. And then the teeny tiny aquifer we're interested in here is the one right there at the hydro camp. The till units are the Good Thunder, and you can see there's a good thickness of some of these. This one is pretty thick. There are subdivisions in here that are listed, even in the New Ulm formation here that I won't go into because I didn't have time to put the breaks in, but it varies between a loam and a sandy loam in various parts there, but it's still very uniform. The Cromwell formation is very stony. We weren't able to do a very good job coring that at the Cromwell site, and the Hewitt formation is the sandiest unit of all and is very interesting. And this is, and that one has an aquifer on top, as does Cromwell for a little bit, as does Litchfield. And that may enter into the story at some point, although I'm not sure if today I'm going to talk much about that, but we may. And this is the first aquifer that I can talk about. I had a little problem with the diagram. Okay. So I want to go back here before I show this. So one of the things I want to show is you should be able to kind of postulate, and we've already talked about this morning, that if you have particular grain size or particle size, that should inform you as to what the hydraulic conductivity should be. All right? So what you're going to see is a series of diagrams. Let's see if I can get out of that. Yes. Series of diagrams. Olivia will it'll be the same order. Olivia will be on the left, and the hydro camp will be on the right. So we're going to clay loam to sandy loam here. And you'll notice here that, yeah, that kind of works, but, you know, the K value, and these are in feet per day, the K value of the Olivia site is probably a little higher than it should be for a clay loam that you might expect. And then we go over the Litchfield site, and there are two Litchfield sites here, and you can see that there's one that's up here, not a high number, but you can see that. And in fact, these are medians here, so these are box plots with medians. And then you go 100 feet away, and you see that the hydraulic conductivity is down here. Okay, so same unit, 2,500 feet apart, different K values, at least in that section. And then we go over to the Cromwell site here, and you can see that it's probably very consistent with a sandy till, and even sandier till, it's very consistent up here. So you have a couple of ringers out here that will come back to haunt us later in the talk as to what's going on. Now, for those of you that have no idea what I'm talking about, I put these in meters per second, so we can convert to any unit that you want today. I've seen centimeters per second, feet per day, so I deal with meters per second a lot, so I feel comfortable, but these are what the ranges are. Okay, so just to kind of give you some insight into how these particular Des Moines Loeb samples look, I took some of my numbers that I've gleaned over Des Moines Loeb from a number of years, about 48, the box plot to the right. And you can see that the range of K values in the Des Moines Loeb here kind of spans the range of the two sites at Litchfield. All right, so we're not really out of the ballpark. What I would say, though, is that when we see these kinds of values up in the Des Moines lobe, we often see fractures and evidence of fracture flow. And if you're interested in that particular concept, my student Nathan Young has a poster in the room back there. I'm going to be Nathan Young today because he had the TA Neil Iverson's class today. So he's not here. Okay, so what I want to just point out next, if I can get out of this, is that those kinds of things should also inform what the vertical hydraulic gradients are. All right? So if you believe in Darcy's law, if you change the K value, then that would change the gradient, and those things would be related if the flux is still the same. I put these up as points first to just emphasize a couple of different things. First of all, we put these tubes in the ground. We hope for the best. But, in fact, they're just points. And we don't know what's going on in between the points. And because groundwater is a three-dimensional flow system, we have no idea what's even going on in two dimensions, let alone three. So we're looking at a column straight down, and we're hoping it's going to tell us something. All right? Just to kind of get that across here, in case some of you are skeptical. The other thing I want to point out is, as one of my graduate students, who's former grad students, is sitting kind of over there somewhere, has always pointed out to me that just because you measure heads, it's just potential. It doesn't mean flow. Okay? And I think all of us have heard that before. And my job here is to convince you that the flow is occurring, but I'm sure there are still flow deniers out there that will come after me later. What I want to emphasize here is the fact that what I'm going to do next is to put lines in between these. And those lines are simply to help you figure out which sites are which. Okay? They don't imply any continuity of process, continuity of flow, any of that stuff. I mean, we're shooting in the dark here. I'm killing my own talk here, I think. Jeez. Okay, so we're going to go through the sites and look at the hydraulic head values here. Okay, we're going to start with Olivia. Olivia is the one in the purple, and you can see, and you'll notice that these are all in the same scale. Okay, and I think that's really important when you're comparing sites, because our temptation when we do these diagrams is to stretch them out as much as possible and show the maximum kind of gradient, all right? Well, I've done that. Maybe you don't. But here, we put them at the same scale. So you can see Olivia in this diagram. These are diagrams that I've made. Blue is negative or downward flow. Red is positive or upward. So you can see we're in the blue. This is all negative flow here, all right? So we're going downward. And so we've got a fairly moderate gradient up through here, okay, downward. And then a huge gradient at the bottom. And that huge gradient is caused by, a very thin lacustrine unit that's at the very base of this tilt column. And if Ken Bradbury were here, he would tell you that those units, small that they are, can really cause a very hard deflection of that vertical gradient curve that we're looking at. So that's the problem, then, with having these very widely spaced columns and things between. We don't really know sometimes what's going on in between there. We're just kind of guessing. All right, so this is a good example of that. If you're interested, in fact, if you're bothered by gradients over 1, because this one's over 2, which is really exciting, Dave Hart, Ken Bradbury, and Madeline Gothwitz put out a nice paper in 2008 in a technical commentary that talked about actually how this happens and that it's necessary in these fine-grained materials for water to flow. Litchfield, all of a sudden here, Litchfield 1, we start to up the gradient. That happens right through the center, right through here, and the gradient's about 0.24 downward. This is a really typical gradient in the materials that I've looked at. Okay, we're not talking about 0.05 or 0.1. We're talking higher here. Okay, a little bit of upper gradient here that's probably not essential. All right, let's go to Litchfield 2. All right, and you can see here that gradient's very strong through this. Now remember that some of the funky K values were actually occurring in Olivia and Litchfield 1. In Litchfield 2, we had the low K values, and you can see the result of that is this very steep gradient right through here, but not so much at the top. So something's happening, maybe a change in the density, maybe a change in the vertical hydraulic conductivity at that point to cause this increase in the gradient. All right, but again, we don't necessarily know that, and we'll talk about some of that later. All right, let's move over to, I forgot about this. So back to Iowa, all right? Do we see these in Iowa in the Des Moines Lobe? Yeah, all the time. I mean, these are two sites I have close to Ames. I'd like to give a shout-out to Jim Item and Beth Johnson, who put this well nest in 1993, and we're still monitoring it. even though we've all gotten older, the wells have not, okay? But you can see here that we've got vertical gradients. This is actually, it's pretty shallow up top, but the vertical gradient here is higher in the till. And then when we get down in the Luss, it's still high. And down here, we hit a paleosol that makes it higher. And this is actually a Luss unit that we can get a very high vertical gradient in it, too. So this happens all the time. So it's not unusual and speaks to some of the processes that are going on. Cromwell was in a bit of an anomaly because the gradient was up. There's a potentiometric high in the slate aquifer, all right? But if you know, that may be only part of the deal. If you follow Jesse Meyer's work and looking at flow in fractured rock, you see that you can go downward and see basically flow up, flow down in a single column in a fractured rock sequence. So, you know, this may be due to a lot of different factors. But we're not going to talk about this site anymore because it's hard to get recharge downward if you're got an upper gradient. I'm just testing you here, okay? All right, and then the final site actually is the HFC site. Remember, this is the sandiest site of all of them. And the vertical gradient is 0.05. Jesse told me last week that if it's 0.02 or lower, we call them unresolvable vertical gradients, okay? So we barely made the cutoff here. So the question is, well, is there flow at all going on at the site? Well, we'll get into that later. All right, so this is the gradient story. So you can use this, just as Bob showed, to actually calculate travel times that are pretty ridiculous, all right? Average linear velocities here, we use the porosity of 0.25 just for fun. You can get to the bottom of the till at LF1 in 2 years. Well, that doesn't seem right, okay? Some of these are a little higher, but you'll notice LF1 and HFC have high ones. Olivia is in the middle, and this LF2 site, which has the lowest K value, is much much lower. And if you steal some of Justin's thunder from this afternoon, you'll see that some of these, actually, these numbers are from his vertical K measurements, and those slow them down a little bit. This is the tortoise part. In general, we would think that there's probably a difference between the horizontal K that we get from slug tests at that scale and the vertical K that you get from pumping tests, and so that's been an account here. But Justin will argue with me later on this, I think. Okay, so chemistry of the rescue. All right, so what do we find then that would tell us that some of these things are actually right or not? Here's Alyssa Witt doing her sampling for the pore water samples, which we did. We also did groundwater sampling. And this is a preview of looking at Delta 018 and what it may or may not tell us. So that's the next slide. We do a lot of age estimating from Delta 018 in the subsurface. If you're in glacier ice, you ought to be down around this range. Lake Agassiz from Vicky Remenda's study was in this range. Jim Berg just did a great study, if you've not seen it, on Clay County. It has a range in this age underneath the Lake Agassiz sediments there. And I actually worked on this for my PhD in the last century and got a minus 18. I see I'm not even making the cut here. But if you look at the range of pore water and groundwater in our system, that's the range, 8.33 to 11.61 negative. All right. So we're not even in the ballpark of even being glacial ice meltwater or in a climate that was very immediately post-glacial. So we're not glacial at all. So the idea is we're younger than that. So that gives us a little bit of a constraint on that. All right, I've not given up for my quest for ice, but it's not happening. Minnesota, you disappoint me in that regard. Okay, so all of you know that we used to have bombs blowing up in the air, okay? It was a great boom for hydrologists, but not for people. And so in this case, we're going to look at tritium. And this is the part that I think is the most controversial, so hold your yelling and screaming until later, because I'm going to give a little different slant on it than the kind of the traditional Minnesota interpretation here, okay? So typically in till sites that I've worked on in like three states, the profile generally looks like this. You get some evidence of recent stuff up near the top, and then you immediately go to values below the detection limit, which are generally thought of as pre-bomb or pre-1953, whatever date you want to use there. And it's pretty boring. There's not much you could do with this except to say, well, this is old water down here. And remember, we're assuming that everything goes vertically downward. You know, these are not systems that are like well-mixed sand and gravel aquifers that have things going all over the place. We're assuming the recharge is down and that's exactly what's happening. So, and just keep in mind that this is the higher K moderate head gradient site, and this is the lowest K steepest head gradient site. So we get kind of similar things going on at both sites, which is interesting. Okay, I have to take a drink of water before I go to the next one. So what we found at the Litchfield 1 site and the HFC site are two peaks. All right, now, again, I am drawing lines between these, and I don't know what's going on between these numbers, okay? So just kind of keep that in mind. Anything could be going on between the points here. I chose these dates because if you look at the tritium input curve from mid-Iowa, which is Ames, which I published in a 1995 paper, if you decay that to 2016 and you look at that decay curve, the numbers that you get from these two values come out to be 1966 and 1967, which is kind of odd. All right? Now, I've done some, tried to do some modeling on this, and I'm hopefully going to do that at a later talk. But it could be, in fact, this is the actual peak. The bomb peak in the middle of Ames would probably be about 81 tritium units, decayed down to 2016. So, and there could be diffusion of that, so this could actually be diffusion and dispersion that mess up with the curve. But anyway, this gives us a little bit of a time marker, and if you bear with me, we'll kind of see how this works. Again, we're just neglecting any kind of mixing. There's no dispersion in here as yet, but the modeling will hopefully take care of that. But remember that we've got a higher K steep gradient on one side and the highest K shallow gradient on the other side. So gradient and K doesn't really help us in some of these cases figure out the age of the water in the subsurface. So let's look at anthropogenic tracers to figure this out. All right, we've got plenty of this on the upper left-hand corner in Iowa. We have some of this stuff going on with the salt trucks in Iowa, not as much as up here, though. And then we have sewer pipes that are leaking all over the place, probably like you do up here. I was going to put cryptosporidium in here, but I said, no, I won't do that. Okay. So anyway, so there are lots of things that we can use to back up the hydraulic data, and that's kind of what we're trying to do here. So I'm going to show you some plots here that either show chloride in milligrams per liter or chloride bromide in mass ratios. And the depth is on the y-axis. The blue bar is always groundwater, and the orange bar is always pore water. Okay, so you'll see a bunch of these, and I'll go chloride first, and then chloride-bromide mass ratio. And I'll also put the magic 250 line, which is generally what we say is slam dunk anthropogenic contamination. Most of you know that, and for the chloride-bromide mass ratio, and see how that does. Okay, let's look at Olivia. All right, so now Olivia was boring, you know, with the tritium stuff. Okay, so here's the values. We're already above 2 or 5, whatever your baseline is. All right, we're up around 40 at 20 feet. We're finding chloride down to 60, 105, 145, 175 above baseline. And the tritium data would suggest that anything below 60 feet is older than 1953. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, I mean, if you take the date as solid, that means that we've got stuff in the system before that, all right? And we were polluting the aquifer or the aquitard before 1953. Now, interestingly enough, you'll notice that the pore waters don't agree with that, all right? So that's another thing that we'll see on and off again here on this. The interesting thing here was the chloride-bromide mass ratios. They're pretty much in line up here, and we're above 250 here. But you'll notice that these lower samples, that in fact, they're out of the ballpark. All right? Now, why would you get that? Well, we noticed at this particular place that the bromide concentrations are some of the lowest that we've seen at any of the sites. And we think that we know that bromide likes to get absorbed onto clays and that maybe the clay loam at the Olivia site is doing something, or we got something else going on. But this is interesting. So if you're doing a contamination study of this stuff at this depth, you're in trouble. All right, because you've already gone over what's normal. Litchfield 2, okay, remember this is the low-K, high-gradient site. Between under 57 feet is older than 1953. So you can see that even in the till, which is right at the surface, you're getting way above what we would consider baseline, and we even down to 111 feet. And notice anything below here is older than 53, according to the tritium data, okay? Again, this is like a piston moving downward, all right? We're not mixing all this water up, and I know Jim Berg's probably having a cow right now about all this stuff, but anyway, this is how we do this. Okay, chloride-bromide mass ratios are really high, all right? And here we've hit the 250 mark. So there's funny stuff going on here, and notice that there's a disparity here between the groundwater and the core water. I don't know what Jerry Seinfeld was saying here, but you'll notice that all of a sudden we get to the hydrogeology field camp, and the chloride values are really negligible. All right? Now, remember, if we take the tritium dates, between 150 and 96, it's between 53 and 67. Okay? So it looks like not much is getting down there. Well, what's different about this site than the other sites? It's in a forest. Okay? So we're suggesting, at least I'm suggesting here, I guess I maybe should even pull that back a little bit, but the urban sites have definitely shown more chloride in their system than this site. Okay? So that's something to be thinking about. And we're not even close to being close to 250 here. So if you want to put a well in, this is a great place. Go up and visit Scott Alexander up at the site, and we'll make it happen. Okay, so I think there's evidence here that chloride is getting down to this unit. If we get the date thing worked out, and maybe before I leave today we'll get that worked out, there's stuff that's getting down there. And I think that's the surprise, all right? That's the surprise. What's the process for it to get down there? So my summary is that the head relationship suggests that groundwater is leaking to the underlying confined aquifer, except for Cromwell, which is in the opposite direction. But I think the leak magnitude reflects the site-specific conditions, in particular the combination of gradient and hydraulic conductivity. But in any case, if you think this stuff is impermeable, think again, because the travel times are definitely shorter than billions of years, or even glacial times. We said that it's post-glacial groundwater more than likely. We think we've got funny stuff going on with the tritium, at least the two sites. All right, and we've got some, you know, you may argue with this, but we've got some information that shows penetration of those anthropogenic tracers to depth, particularly at the urban sites. And then what the heck is going on with the pore water versus the groundwater? All right? Not a lot of people do the pore squeezing. They do it a lot in clays, not in this kind of stuff. Is this a sampling issue where we're sampling a smaller volume of water versus maybe a 5-foot sand pack? Are we looking at something like we're crushing chloride out of all the grains, did I spit into the sample vials, and that's the problem, okay? So, but Jared will now solve all this with the modeling explanation.
Well, thanks for hanging in there. I know lunch is next, so I just ask you to listen for just a little bit longer. All right, so a quick review of what Bill talked about. The field studies demonstrated that groundwater does flow through till. So groundwater is in the race, so to speak. And till hydraulic properties are highly variable. And so this is just kind of a schematic thinking about the Litchfield site. We've got one area where it seems much more conductive. Within a half mile, there's another area that's much less conductive. And so how do we try to start to conceptualize this for modeling? And so the modeling challenges, we have till hydraulic properties that are variable and often unknown. The extents of and connections between buried aquifers is also largely unknown. MGS has done a great job mapping these things, but trying to get that down to a relevant modeling scale is still a challenge. And so we set out to just examine a few questions. So how does pumping affect groundwater flow through till? Where does the water enter the aquifer, and which model parameters, if you're setting up a model, which model parameters are most important? And so we did some conceptual or interpretive groundwater modeling. This isn't a real place in space. This is an imaginary place, but it gave us a chance to plug in the different values that we found at our various field sites and see what happens when you start pumping this confined aquifer. And so we did this in ModFlow 2000, And I worked with Daniel Feinstein on this modeling effort. And we did a series of different model scenarios, and we varied a lot of different parameters, and I'll get into that. So this kind of just lays out our model setup. I can let you read that, and I just wanted to highlight a couple of things here. This red box is what we called our local area, and that's where we did some of the flux calculations that I'll talk about in subsequent slides. The gray is our confined aquifer of interest, and the three blue dots are the wells that are pumping from that confined aquifer. And then these green lines are our streams, and the yellow are lakes, ponded water at the surface. And the next slide, I will show you a cross-section through the middle of the model. That's what this looks like. Very colorful to help you get to lunch. And so the upper unit, in most cases, you saw this in Bill's slides, that the upper unit is typically an aquifer, or sandier material. So in most cases in our modeling, we had a 40 feet of aquifer material, and then we have 80 feet of till divided into three layers, and then we have the buried aquifer here in the middle, and then what we call the middle unit, and we varied the middle unit between aquifer-type material to tight till type material. And then beneath this is a till. Okay, and so general descriptions of our model scenarios. So what we did is we varied that vertical hydraulic conductivity of the upper till. And then we also varied the horizontal hydraulic conductivity of that middle unit. Again, thinking about, we often don't know the hydraulic properties of the till or how well connected that aquifer is that we're trying to understand. So we're experimenting with variations in those things here. And so our response variable then that we use to characterize this is the percent of the total volume of water entering the aquifer. So we measured things in a couple ways. So one was measuring the total volume of water entering the aquifer from above and from the sides and from below. All right? And so when we do that, this is the ranges of things that we get. And so we varied the vertical conductivity of the till between 0.001 and 2 feet per day, which is extending beyond our observed values a little bit, but it is definitely within the range of things that we observed. And then we varied the KH of the middle unit, the horizontal hydraulic conductivity of the middle unit, between 0.05 and 30 feet per day. 0.05 is like a very isolated aquifer. And then the 30 feet per day is something that is either very laterally extensive or potentially connected to another aquifer. And so what you can see just by varying these, not surprisingly, you see huge ranges in where that flux is entering the aquifer. And so in the case where we have a tight till on the top and a tight till along the side of the aquifer, we actually get about 5% of the flow coming in through the base of the aquifer. But as soon as you start letting more water in other places, then that flux really drops off to less than 1%. And when you have a tight till alongside the aquifer and a more conductive till over top of the aquifer, you get a lot more downward flux. Not surprising, and Justin will talk about these leakage factors in his aquifer test. So this is kind of reinforcing that. But you can just see that there's a lot of variability in where the water is coming from with this test. Okay, and then we wanted to look at the leakage, the flux of water into the top of the till from the surficial unit. So we're looking at the water that's leaking from that surficial aquifer into the till and thinking about questions of sustainability. You know, it's how much water we can get out, but it's how is it impacting other resources as well. And so I should mention all of these models were steady state, so we're kind of looking at things to infinity here. But it gives us an idea of how these model parameters affect flux of water through the system. So we're looking at the percent of the total groundwater flux within our local area that is going down into the till. And so the other fluxes that are happening in that surficial unit are the lateral fluxes and the recharge and any induced flow, because we had some streams. You can see some streams going in here. So it's adding up all of those fluxes and saying what percent of this flux is moving into the till. And so here is, there's a lot going on in this graph. We'll step through it here. So this shows the effect of varying those till properties. Okay, so we're just varying the hydraulic conductivity of these till layers here. And we didn't vary those independently. It was a wholesale change all of the KB of that entire sequence. And then this is the percent of the downward flux of that surface flux. So we varied from a Litchfield-like till, that tighter till, up to a Cromwell-like till. And I just would like to point out first the gray bars. So you can see without pumping, it makes sense in a tight till, you don't have much groundwater flow getting down into the till, only 2% of that overall flux. So there's a lot of lateral flow happening in that superficial aquifer. And then as you make your till more leaky, more conductive, you can see that there's a lot more downward flux from that superficial unit. So the gray bars make a lot of sense that in what's happening there. What was interesting is when you added pumping, you increased that flux into that till a lot with the tight till. And so that was a little bit counterintuitive. And this, I should say, the horizontal hydraulic conductivity of that underlying aquifer was tight. So we basically have a very isolated aquifer here. So you see a big increase in the amount of vertical flux happening there. But you see much less of an effect when you already had a leaky till. You're increasing that downward flux some, but not nearly as much. Okay, and now if we vary the horizontal hydraulic conductivity, a similar graph, and here we're varying the properties of this middle unit bordering the aquifer. Okay, and this scenario one is the same one I showed on the previous graph, and here you can see the KV of the till, in this case, is the tightest till, 0.001. And so you can see in all cases, when you're varying the KH of that middle unit, you don't see much of a change in the vertical flux without pumping. But you add pumping, and then you start to see, again, more vertical flux heading into that till unit. But here, if you think you've got a tight till on the top and a laterally extensive aquifer, you're basically going to spread out your radius of influence. And so you're seeing the red bars are declining, and they're kind of getting beyond our area of local influence. And so you can see that effect here in this model. Okay, so those are two examples. We looked at the KH of that middle unit and then the vertical conductivity of the till. And then we did a sensitivity analysis on a few other parameters as well and looked at the relative sensitivity of changes in the model parameters and how much that caused this change in downward flux. And when we looked at that, the most sensitive parameters were the KV of the upper till unit and then parameters related to the aerial extent of conductive materials in that buried system. So the size of the buried aquifer, the lateral extent of the buried aquifer, and then the lateral conductivity of that buried aquifer. Less sensitive parameters were the aquifer horizontal hydraulic conductivity, the pumping rate, the screen length, whether the screen of the well was partially penetrating or fully penetrating, and the upper till thickness. So we can see that understanding, this exercise just demonstrates that understanding that those till properties are important for evaluating sustainability. Okay, so overall conclusions then from this thought experiment. One, groundwater flows through till to a confined aquifer. When you add pumping, it increases the leakage of the water from that superficial system into the till. And that third, that leakage into the till induced by pumping is sensitive to the properties of the till. And fourth, that leakage into the aquifer is dependent on the hydraulic properties of the till. So properties of the till became important in the way that we evaluated this and two of those points. So I just wanted to, now we've gone through a lot of different things on this project, and I just wanted to bring you back to the very beginning and say this was our goal, was to look at the variability of the till hydraulic properties. And I think Bill did a great job showing that variability. And then we wanted to look at the leakage of water from till confining units to buried confined aquifers. And again, with the goal of understanding sustainability. So thinking about that then, overall conclusions. First is that groundwater in till is definitely in the race. We had multiple lines of evidence for groundwater flow through till. The hydraulic head relationships, we have post-glacial groundwater, anthropogenic tracers at depth, particularly at the urban sites, and then the modflow model demonstrated this as well. So whether we have tortoise or hare flow, I think we've got evidence for wide-ranging leakage rates, and even at a single site, thinking about Litchfield. And so implications. So implications for sustainability. So the modeling suggests that hydraulic information about till is just as important for mapping and understanding sustainable water withdrawals as mapping aquifer extents. And so that's a key thing that came out from that exercise. Other implications. So implications for conceptualization of till. First, as I mentioned at the beginning when the computer wasn't working, expect surprises. Simple conceptual models are likely not applicable. So we need to rethink this. And till is not all impermeable, and the velocities may be higher than previously assumed. And so I just want to caution you, don't get crazy with it. But with that, thank you for listening, and I'd be happy, or Bill, if you want to come up, be happy to take any questions.
So I'm sure there will be some questions for both Bill and Jared.
So is age dating a better tool than extensive aquifer testing and till testing?
That's kind of a loaded question. So those of you that know me know that my whole deal is understand the hydraulics and let the chemistry help you understand the hydraulics. And so I think chemistry by itself is not sufficient in a lot of cases where you don't know the hydraulics at all. So I think the marriage of those two things, they help each other. So I guess to answer the question more directly, I like doing the age dating stuff, but it's not straightforward always. And we found over the years that, you know, things like carbon-14 don't work well in all places, and tritium has issues, like, you know, I kind of tried to point out today. So I think you got to have both, and I really think, and now with the entry of viruses into our groundwater systems, that gives us another great age dating tool that we may not want cryptosporidium in our water, but it tells us something. So, yeah. Is that close?
Great talk, gentlemen. Thank you very much for that. As a glacial geologist of way back, your talk sounds to me a little bit like a murder mystery where you've introduced all the clues, but the culprit has not been identified yet. And I'd like you to talk about the distribution of fractures as they may play a role in this, and specifically relationships to things like isostasy, the rebound from glaciation, and as well oxidization of the till versus the unoxidized till.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, Jim, thank you for that question. Thank you, too, Kelton. So I've been really involved in this subject going back over the last 20 years. It wasn't a direct kind of part of this study to look at fractures, but from what I've seen in Iowa and what we're doing in Iowa, I think we've got interesting information that may inform some things that we didn't really know before. And I think what we found is that sometimes, especially in the oxidized zone, where the K values are high, there's no other explanation than to have fractures in there to do that. And we've actually developed a method to actually, you know, map those out and do that stuff. So if you want to see Nathan's poster, Nathan just finished his PhD, so I guess he passed. So he's good, you know. Deeper is always a problem. I know Kerry said something about 12 meters. John Cherry's seen them deeper than that. We've seen them deeper than that, okay? What we've tried to emphasize is that, there's kind of fracture spacing does increase as you go down. We see desiccation fractures in some of the older tills, which I bet we would see in the Good Thunder Formation if we had it on an outcrop. In the tills in the Des Moines Lobe and the late Wisconsin stuff, what we see are kind of a weird northeast, southwest, northwest, southeast fracture set that doesn't bear really any relationship to glacier ice direction. But that doesn't mean that the ice couldn't change locally and cause those. And I don't think we see a lot of evidence of rebound stuff. I guess I haven't thought about that a lot, which doesn't mean anything. But, I mean, it just, we haven't thought about that. So, but I think what I'm on kind of a, one of the things we tried to do with Nathan's study was to honor the fracture kind of paradigm and try to bring it to larger scales. So what we find in Iowa is that a lot of our studies, they say, oh, yeah, that fracture stuff is nice, but we're going to model out the till as basically a standard porous media. And that doesn't work real well if you know that they're there. And so what we've tried to do is develop a method through using a representative elementary volume concept to bring those to bigger scales. And actually, if Nathan had another year, he would have kind of gotten that whole scale. But we have a method to do that. So I think it's something that needs to be in the conversation. And in particular, the stuff, the viruses kind of inform us about how fast things can get down. And really, in many cases, there's no other explanation when you have a tight unit or a tight shale or something like that to get that stuff down to where it should be. And, you know, well contamination by a bad well driller or something only goes so far. And when we can't explain it any other way, I think that has to be in the conversation. So that's my pitch for today. Thank you.